This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am one of your hosts, Chris Spangle. To my right is Greg Linz.
Hello, everybody.
And to my left is Gina Martinez.
Hello, hello.
Also around is Maya Axton.
Hey, baby.
And Emily Bang, our silent participant. She's always here monitoring Maya to make sure that she's okay. And then on the Google Hangout, we've got Creighton Harrington, one of the OGs, one of the founders of We Are Libertarians. Creighton, how are you doing? He's doing well. Joe Ruiz is also on the line. Joe, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Wait, what does OG stand for?
Original.
Gangsta?
Original gangsta.
Original.
So, and then Travis Weick is also monitoring
I can accept that.
The Google Hangout. Now, this is a very special We Are Libertarians. This is our 50th episode
Woo-hoo.
Of We Are Libertarians. Everybody give us a round of applause. All right, thank you.
Yay.
Appreciate that. It's going to be a little bit of because it is our 50th episode, we wanted to have a little bit of a celebration and have everybody on. Chris Galt, Creighton Harrington, and I started this podcast in March of 2012. As a way to reach out to the local college groups and talk about politics. And it just turned out to be a lot of fun. And we continued to do it. And then when I left the Libertarian Party of Indiana, we stole it from the Libertarian Party of Indiana. We took it by force and violated the NAP, launched the website, brought on Joe and Greg. Maya has always kind of been around. Gina ran for office, and Gina has joined on as a full-time co-host of the show. And it's been a fun 50 episodes. I would say that one of my favorite episodes is probably number 16, our interview with Goose from the military, one of Creighton's friends. And all of the questions for Goose, who we wanted to interview an active duty military person, and all of the questions that Creighton answered were related to a movie. Creighton only had a frame of reference for movies. So
did you really hook up with the girl who trained you at the Top Gun Institute?
Right. So that was one of my favorites is titled The Fight. And you'd have to go back to the website because we had some feed issues. So we're only doing 15 episodes on the feed now. And it was the infamous fight between co-host Creighton Harrington and then co-host Chris Galt. It was over.
Hence the rest in peace.
It was over conspiracy theories, and things had been heated and tense for a couple of weeks. We get off air, and then they have a fight. one of them tried to punch the other. I won't say which one, but it wasn't Creighton. And and so it was.
How did I miss that?
It was fantastic. I mean, it was. You know, we can all laugh about it now, but all the good times are from back in the old days when Galt was on the show, so you're all fired, and I'm sad to say I have to bring Galt back because he was entertaining. But he is a dearly beloved part of this show. Maya, stop it. Maya's social terrorism is out in full force. Greg, what is probably your favorite memory over the last 50 episodes so far?
I really enjoyed the discussion. It was actually you three on that couch, so Spangle, Gina, and Maya, and then Creighton and I, and we were talking about right after the Boston Massacre.
Yeah.
Or the Boston bombing. Yeah.
Right.
That was a very fun episode, and it got quite heated, and I'm pretty sure I threatened to blow up the entire Muslim world.
I do remember that, because that was Gina's first episode, and Maya was on, and, like, we all just, it was like one of those episodes, you know, it's been a good episode when everybody leaves and you just can't wait to leave because you don't want to talk to these people anymore.
Sometimes, everything there was to say.
Yeah. And Creighton, I think you, I mean, you and Galt used to go at it all the time back in the early days. And like, there were times where you would end a show and like the two of you just would not stop. And like the arguments would just continue and it kind of would get vicious a little bit.
I tried.
There's a little bit.
I tried to make it fun.
Yeah. So there are times where you just leave the show and you've had arguments, and I have a feeling today may be one of those episodes with one of the topics that we've got, and you're just like, all right, I need a week not to talk to these people. So, Maya, what was probably your favorite memory of the We Are Libertarians?
Probably the first, and I'm not going to say this just because it's me, but because I never really paid attention to it when you guys first started there in the campaign headquarters. The first episode I was on, because that's the first real, right. I was actually allowed in the room and I could actually hear you guys.
It's true.
That was fun because it was me, you, Galt, and Crichton, and we just sat there and talked about philosophy. It was real simple. We didn't really get into a bunch of issues. That was just simple and fun. That was kind of like, literally, we have beer now. But back then, we should have had beer and just been sitting in a fireplace, campfire place, just hanging out talking. That was probably old school that nobody listened to, nobody will ever want to listen to, but that was, I liked it back then.
Yeah,
nothing gets ratings like libertarian philosophy.
Right. Yeah, I can verify no one was listening back
then.
No, but
that was definitely a different kind of thought.
It was definitely a different kind of show. It's evolved a little bit. All right, so Gina, you don't have many memories.
The first one, though, the one that we all agreed was, awesome.
Right.
All right, so now it's this.
Yeah.
That one was definitely the best one that I've set in on so far.
Let's go to the online guys. Let's start with Joe, and then we'll end with Creighton. And maybe we'll even ask Travis, since Travis has listened from episode one and on. And by the way, Maya, I want to congratulate you. You actually gave a serious answer, and you didn't say, "They all suck.
I hate white people."
Right, okay. Okay. Joe, what is probably your favorite, just reflecting back, so if people want to go back and
everything.
Listen to maybe some of the past episodes, what were some of your greatest hits?
Prior to me coming on, I think the Chick-fil-A commentary that you guys did was pretty funny. That was good stuff. I love the first episode a few weeks before Gina was officially a contributor when she came on and couldn't control her mouth, and I thought that was hilarious. And I got to hear her call you Spangle Bear for the first time, and that was really awesome for me too.
That was awesome for me.
And then anytime you let me do the overzealous European impression is good for me too.
Tonight, it sounds like.
Oh yeah, I take it back. Joe's Google guy. That is my favorite of everything we've ever done.
Joe, hit us with it.
Hello, we are libertarians. So wonderful to see you.
Joe's wife and kids cannot stand that voice.
Oh, I can imagine.
Like, it's an instant, there's just no sex.
She starts contacting attorneys as soon as he says it.
Now, 50 episodes in, 2 years of knowing Creighton, and Maya still cannot pronounce Creighton's name correctly. It's Creighton, not Crichton. Like, he's some sort of, like, crouton. It's Creighton.
I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, I don't care.
Creighton, what is, out of all these 50 episodes, what is your favorite We Are Libertarians memory?
Outside of getting to yell at Galt all the time, I guess I'd have to say when me and Niece got into a very, very in-depth talk about anarcho-syndicalism and whatever the heck he was talking about, mutualism and all that crap.
Right.
I'm a nerd, so that was probably my favorite.
We
definitely killed that episode. We literally killed that episode. Like, no one listens to that episode because of that talk, but I liked it.
No, see, that is not the first Niece. Niece was on way back in the day. Niece came on the second time, and that was one of my favorite moments when Niece showed up like 2 hours.
An hour and 45 minutes into the podcast.
Hi. allegedly
had $100 bill in his pocket, and that was it. You got this kind of cash?
He had more money than I had. He just, you know, he has not been around lately, so I'm not sure what he's up to. He might be in a field somewhere being James. He might be, who knows? James will pop up at some point.
I haven't seen him. I keep looking for him doing those rings of fire at Broad Ripple Dog Park on Wednesday nights, and I have yet to run into him there.
Travis, you've listened. You've probably listened to the majority of the shows, I'd say, right? I mean, you've listened from day one.
I have. I've listened to most of them, probably like 85%, I'd say.
So if you were to recommend an episode or a moment that people could go back and check out, what would you say?
Definitely the one Creighton was just talking about with Nice. I love that. I love that whole thing with him and Nice going back about, well, here's anarcho capitalism and here's all this craziness. Anytime Nice is on, it's fantastic. I loved the fight. The fight was amazing, especially the behind-the-scenes stuff, the director's cut that was going on backstage. I loved it.
We used to put a lot of Easter eggs in at the end of the show. We don't do that as much anymore because we don't roll tape and there's not too many shenanigans, but we did last week. At the end of last week's episode, Maya stormed out in quite a hissy fit. She was taking up the tampon mantle from Galt. And
no.
Where Snowden was.
She's sitting there ranting and talking under everybody as the episode is going on.
Because you were getting the facts wrong.
But that doesn't mean that you get to sit there and talk during the middle of the episode.
But you were getting the facts wrong.
It doesn't matter.
We're libertarians, not we are CNN.
We were... Oh, you bastard.
Careful. This is the Spangle Factor, and you've entered the no-spin zone, Maya.
What, Creighton?
Hey, Maya. I just wanted to let you know that Austin Peterson's water gun march went off excellently today.
I'm so happy to hear that Austin Peterson made fun of anyone protesting for serious liberty in this country. I'm so happy that making fun of
Oh, give me a break.
Care,
he actually got media coverage.
It's because he's a whore to the media. He loves being on RT. I mean, everyone talks shit about Adam Kokesh being paid by RT.
Does anyone else find it hilarious that Maya's mocking other people for attention whoring? Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
My attention
absolutely.
Whoring helps you, not, and you promote it. You're
not
the
only,
one that taught me how to do it.
Shh, let Creighton talk. What, Creighton?
Hey, not only did he make a point, he raised money and donated Toys for Tots and raised money for charity.
What was the point of the Austin Peterson
rally?
You
got to admit that it was...
Austin Peterson, who I personally like, and Maya's opinions reflect only Maya's opinion. Austin Peterson is the former producer of Freedom Watch with the Judge, Judge Napolitano. He worked at Fox News with the Judge, and he works at FreedomWorks now, I think. And he had a water gun rally today. What was the overarching message of the rally today, Creighton?
The people that would be marching on the 4th are idiots.
I said Creighton.
I actually didn't go. I forgot to wake up in time. I forgot it was today. But it was just basically, you know.
What was that about media coverage?
Yeah.
Hey, he did get media coverage.
Just not here.
But I was just asleep. He basically, it was just to point out that gun owners aren't a bunch of crazy people like the media tries to portray them.
Like mine.
And I think he did a good job. It was just a bunch of people with toy guns, and they donated all the toy guns to Toys for Tots and then raised some more money for charity.
Now,
and then they had a bunch of kids there playing like games out on the mall and stuff.
Now, Creighton, to defend Maya, he did really start that rally to kind of make fun of Adam Kokesh. Admit it.
He stated such.
No, honestly, I think he did to an extent, but I think it kind of came into its own after a while.
It did. It
tried,
did turn
he
into
began
a charity
to use it
thing.
As a way to show that libertarians, honestly, to be honest, he kind of saved libertarians from looking like a bunch of crazy people, because that's what Adam Kokesh's march would have made us look like.
Well, his march is still happening, just not in D.C. and. So we're crazy people, and you, Mr. Pass a Law, are not crazy people.
Stop.
Okay. So we can't call you guys crazy, but we're crazy just for wanting to carry guns.
You, Maya, personally aren't crazy. Adam Kokesh is crazy because it was honestly, it was just, I from the bottom of my heart, I think he was just trolling. Wasn't about some making some overarching point. He was trolling.
Then how come the event's still happening in all 50 state capitals with plenty of membership going?
What, next year?
No, tomorrow. I'm helping organize the one here in Indy tomorrow, and there's one in all 50 state capitals. There's a Adam Kokesh started the event page, and that's all that he has left on it. Everything else, there are open carry marches from a voluntarist perspective telling the government that it's overstepped its bounds and it must shut itself down tomorrow.
Okay.
Everywhere.
Maya, I will give you $100 if in 1 year the United States federal government is gone.
You know what? I will give you $50,000.
Yeah, the currency wouldn't it matter. Better be like gold. Better money at that point.
I will give you $50,000.
I'll give you $100. I'll give you the equivalent of $100 in bitcoins.
No, I will give you. I will take out a personal loan and give you $50,000. Sell everything I own if you can get the NDAA repealed. If you can get, if you can repeal the IRS, and. Well, and that means get rid of the income tax code. And if you can get rid of one constitutional amendment, say like the 16th or the 17th. If you can do that, I will give you $50,000. You have more unattainable goals than I do. We're just going to say that.
I don't know. I mean, you could theoretically get the...
I would say that dissolving the federal government...
It's 100 years since we had the income tax.
...is a little bit more unattainable.
Oh. Ugh. It'd be super easy to get rid of the federal government.
All right. Well, that has been amusing.
I've got $100 in bitcoins that says that it won't work.
Welcome to the 4th of July special.
We're so patriotic, we call for the end of government.
Shit. Remember that country we loved? Oh, I had a suggestion for tonight, guys, and you don't have to stick to it like hard and fast.
That's what she said.
But it feels like we've been doing a lot of bitching lately, and so my thought is... Try to say something positive if you're able. Maya, I know this will be exceptionally hard for you. And if you do bitch about something, try to offer a prospective solution.
All right.
Only because it's the 4th of July, we can love our country for a show.
Like now?
Like, I don't know. Now's fine.
Okay. All right.
I think there is.
Hey, you know me. You know me. I'm not going to do anything but talk awesome about the 4th of July. That's like, I am all,
that
all
is,
about, you know, the Declaration of Independence and stuff. That's like my character.
That is Creighton's, I mean, it has fireworks and trucker hats and tank tops and country music.
And for tonight's show, Twinkies.
Oh, yeah.
Only on the casting couch,
no,
though.
No, I swear to God. this is the level of change that we are doing in Young Americans for Liberty. We bought a flag, a rebel flag with Hank Williams Jr. face on it to hang in the office.
Oh,
that's how American we are.
That's American.
My God.
For those of who don't know, Creighton is actually out interning for Young Americans for Liberty. Gina is currently...
They actually sponsor the podcast, right? Our opinions reflect all of Young Americans for Liberty.
Yes, this is paid for by Young Americans for Liberty.
They do not.
No, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, we just got a donation. We're going to put their ad up there.
Yeah.
It's going to say, Young Americans for Liberty, support the Adam Kokesh March.
We're talking about how much Young Americans...
Cream-filled yellow things are flying at my face.
Okay. All right, we're going to have to try and keep some semblance of discipline in this episode, given that we have so many people on the line.
Did you just try to discipline me?
Yes.
Good luck.
It's mostly the people to my left, not the people online or to my right. It's mostly this general area of the
social
show.
Terrorist and the politician.
The social terrorist wing of We Are Libertarians. We're going to have some discipline.
I always want to just remind you and everyone in the listening audience and everyone on Google Plus right now.
You don't care.
You created this.
I know.
You are to blame for everything
Dr.
that I am and do.
Frankenstein.
All right, so Creighton, give us the standard disclaimer. We were joking about Young Americans for Liberty. What is, in fact, our relationship with Young Americans for Liberty?
No relationship.
That's right. We have no
at
relationship.
All.
They are not affiliated with this podcast at all.
Is it because we're not Young Americans, or is it because we hate Liberty?
We're old Americans who love statism.
Yes.
We'll just go with that. We'll just say Chris Spangle's too old.
That's right. Thank you. I think I might be the oldest one of the podcast. No, Gina's the elderly one at like 31.
Way to just blurt her age out.
I don't think she's 31. I don't even know what her age is. I'm just guessing. Gina brought a box of, are these stolen Twinkies?
No, these are legit Twinkies from the Great Twinkie Crisis of 2013.
So you bought these Twinkies?
The day that they announced that the union shit went down and they were closing their doors, I was the second guy in line at the Wonder Bread store with an armful of, like an armload of Twinkies.
Oh.
Oh my gosh.
Eating this was a mistake.
It was the best mistake of your life.
These expired 7 months
ago.
Yeah,
they look a little hard and misshapen.
Fucking Twinkie, it's a zombie apocalypse.
They taste like they expired 7 months ago.
Give it to me, crybaby.
I'll eat it.
Okay.
Where's your curse pad?
Oh, we're into it now.
22 minutes in, Gina.
All right.
That's actually pretty good.
See, I know.
Well, I'm sure somebody dropped them before me.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing those Twinkies.
Anytime. It's the most American thing on the sofa, about.
No, I'm the most American thing on the sofa.
Between an anarchist and a Canadian? What are you talking about?
My name is Spangle. You don't get more patriotic than a Spangle.
Well, maybe.
Star Spangled Bear.
How did you feel about July 1st, Canadian Independence Day? Was that a good day for you?
Tell us your feelings.
That is a faux holiday.
It is a faux holiday.
That's a Hallmark holiday.
It's not even real. They still are, you know, beholden to the crown. So mm-hmm. It's not like that they're, you know, the Queen's actually their head of state, correct?
Yeah.
Still?
Like, I know facts about Canada. Listen, you don't get to know your enemy. That's like rule number one in the art of war, is don't know anything about your enemy.
I don't think that's the right book.
No, I do.
I think that was Hitler's strategy to war.
What? Let's talk about Egypt. Egypt is currently on fire. Let's talk a little bit about why. What has happened? Let's talk about the events that have led up to this a little bit.
That should be U.S. foreign policy. You guys get your crap together, or we're sending Maya over there.
That's
we are
going to
export some
plan.
Maya all out over you guys.
That's what she said.
So here's essentially what happened. Another angry person tonight is Morsi. He is the president of Egypt. He was ousted by the military today. After the Arab Spring, after they kicked out Hosni Mubarak, who was the dictator there for 40 years, they built a constitution and built out a complete government. And then Morsi, I don't know his first name. Do you know his first name?
Oh, I do, but I can't pronounce it.
Yeah.
I don't mean that racist in any way.
I was going to say, it's all jihad to Greg.
Stop it.
Yes. Durka Durka.
Isn't it Muhammad?
Muhammad Morsi? But isn't there an L and then... No, I'm not even going to say it.
So, Morsi took power, and over the course of the last year, year and a half, he has shown himself to be as corrupt as the dictatorship. You've had all these various factions in Egypt who have been battling each other. It's been battles between the remnants of the old regime. A lot of them are connected to the military. The military was pampered under Mubarak. And he was the way that they were the way that he kept power within the country. And
we have the relationship with the military. We've been training them and
buying them
tanks,
lots of
planes for years,
sending a lot of American dollars over to this military. And the people have not shut down their networks. They're protesting networks, and they've gone out and started protesting the corruption. Morsi has made several huge strategic mistakes lately, and they started protesting, and the people protested to the point that they forced the military's hand to throw out Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood motivated a lot of people to go out and vote for them. They took power in Egypt, and now we've essentially got anarchy taking place, somewhat of an anarchy. Maya shaking her head.
I mean, with the military in control, it's actually probably as stable of situation as you can most likely have in this scenario.
It is essentially a coup d'etat. The people forced the hand of the military to oust Morsi. Morsi lost power this very afternoon. It's July 3rd, 2013, as we record this. And so let's talk about what foreign policy implications this has, and let's talk a little bit about what it may mean for libertarians in this country, modeling ourselves a little bit about after them, the way that they have overthrown their government.
I mean, for the United States, it's the best situation possible because the head of the military was educated here. He went to the Army War College. Yeah.
To who'd we support? We supported the Muslim Brotherhood, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, no,
which means now we're going to go in and we're going to start carpet bombing Egypt.
No, we propped up Mubarak. We formed a strategic relationship for the purpose of having talking, you know,
look,
open
we
minds.
Have not, we do not have complete control over what's happening right now
no,
in Egypt.
But I'm saying...
Which means the American government is going to have to find a way to take control of the situation, because for how long have we had control over there? Since basically, since the UK, they got rid of the UK. And they what, 1922 in Egypt? Is that what it was?
It was a while back.
Basically, not too long after that, we're going to like, hey, you know what? We need control over the Middle East some more. So we're not going to just let this go at all.
You know, yeah, we're not going to intervene unless the protests turn increasingly violent.
Or extremely free.
I don't
Barack
know that
Obama
we need to.
Has shown him,
no,
Barack Obama has shown himself to not really, except for Libya, I mean, he's trying to present himself as a guy that only intervenes in other countries when violence and they start killing their own people and stuff. So I don't think he's going to do anything until that happens.
But in this terrorism,
so if that doesn't happen,
then
I think they're just
going to
let it play out.
And if we do not have, we've spent millions of dollars getting control of there and propping up governments, we're going to just let that go away? That's an asset. We just lost assets in the Middle East, technically, from a government standpoint.
See, for me, the military is our best asset in Egypt.
Well,
that's the one where we have the most control.
They just followed the people that just threw out the guy we supported and the people we supported and the constitution we supported.
We supported the military, but we also supported the government. So we've supported both sides.
Now,
it's like a major corporation supporting both candidates.
Listen, the only reason they supported the Muslim Brotherhood is because that's who the people of Egypt supported.
Wow.
They were just that. There was a lot of anger on the part of a lot of people in America, particularly the neoconservatives, who didn't want to support the Muslim Brotherhood because they said that it was a bunch of Al Qaeda people. But we kind of threw our support behind them because the Egyptian people did.
Well,
so I think to say that we're just going to support the Muslim Brotherhood because we already have kind of misses the point. The impetus for us supporting them in the beginning was because the people had popularly elected them.
Well, if they had, you know, done that, like you say, then 33 million, almost half of the entire population of Egypt, wouldn't have been protesting this right now in such a fashion where they had the military coup.
That's what makes the story crazy. That's what makes the story
is that
so
it was not
so
a majority of people
is that,
that were supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and there was reports of that when
I think you're looking at. I think you're looking at it the wrong way. I think what happened was the majority of the people supported the Muslim Brotherhood, and then the Muslim Brotherhood screwed up and did a bad job. And now the people are not supporting them anymore because they sucked. And now they're showing their anger about that, and they don't support them anymore. I think the Muslim Brotherhood lost a majority of the support. And I think what I was talking about this earlier today with my roommate. I think this shows this is a very strong it's not really a hypothetical anymore. Like, to people who are Democrats, not Democrat Party, but people who believe in democracy in and of itself, this is a pretty interesting question, because you had a government that was popularly elected based upon democratic principles, and now you have what is probably a majority of Egyptians saying they don't like this government anymore, and they have essentially forced the hand of Morsi to step down and the Muslim Brotherhood to step down, but they didn't do it through a democratic process. So I think it's an interesting question for Democrats to posit, because you have the will of the people is saying Morsi should go, but based upon those same democratic principles, he is the legitimate president of that country. I think it's an interesting pickle I think the Democrats are in. I personally think it's a great situation as far as from my perspective, just because you had all this talk about, you know, if radical Islamists get into power in any country, it doesn't have to be Egypt, any country, then it's going to be a domino effect, almost a Truman doctrine with Sharia law. And you had the Muslim Brotherhood was the Islamist candidate, and they got into power, and, you know, Sharia law is Islamic fundamentalism be damned. The people were still upset with how the country was being run, and now they've taken over. I think it's a strong punch in the face for people who go out there and try and fearmonger Americans into supporting these wars, because if we don't, then Al-Qaeda will take over the Middle East.
I mean, it is a hugely strong rejection for the Muslim Brotherhood. They've been working to build this transnational political party for years, and they finally get their guy, their leader, into the presidential position, and then it turns out he lasts, what, a year?
Yeah, and I think it's part of the, you've seen a tightening of civil liberties in Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
The lessening of women's rights, you know. And
a terrible economy, too. I think that's economy. The undercurrent of all this.
It's why you have the ability of the population to create the world's largest political protest, maybe in the history of man,
yeah.
They're
yeah,
saying.
The uprising, I mean, damn near.
Yeah, the uprising has been significant.
It's amazing. It's amazing to see the people going out and standing up for their freedoms. I mean, how organized they are and whether or not they're actually responsible for the military coup that went down today, as opposed to them being out protesting and angry and someone else arranging for a military coup, because we can't really know what the will of the people is when they're amassed like that. But it's at least, I guess, refreshing in this day and age to see people standing up for their rights and taking to the streets.
You've got Tahrir Square, which is anti-Muslim Brotherhood, anti-Morsi. And then you've got another square where you've got the pro-Morsi, pro-Constitution
the Muslim Brotherhood supporters.
Exactly.
And then you've still got Mubarak supporters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have his cronies who are well-connected, especially right. Globally.
Yeah.
So, and they're probably willing to let anything slip into chaos because then they might have a chance to slip back into
yep.
power.
Especially if you go like a parliamentary route when establishing your new setup, well, they would essentially be the deal, they would swing the deals in the parliament.
I think the worst case scenario is that this ignites some sort of regional civil war where you start to see Syria and all these other conflicts, and it just gets consumed into one large regional conflict, and that's just not good for anybody.
No, it's really not good for the moderate. It's not good for the person that just wants basic fundamental rights secured, and then essentially you're free to worship as you choose, you're free to live as you choose. This is the worst possible scenario for them.
Joe, you got any comments on Egypt?
I think that it has some implications in regards to our foreign policy, you know, and I don't think the United States government is going to jump in right away, but I think that they're going to have a very cautious and hawk-like eye to a government that we, you know, if we're given, I think the last number I saw was in Forbes, and it has said there was like around $1.5 billion that we were giving in foreign aid to Cairo annually. And to, you know, a country that we're giving that much money for, especially in a time when we're supposed to be in some economic hardship ourselves, it's interesting to watch this ideal situation that we tried to create for these people who were supposedly ready for democracy and to have all of this happen is just, I mean, to me, it says that if the people are ready for something like democracy and if that's a system of government that the people want, the people will create it. They've shown today or in recent days that they have the power to make something happen if there's enough people who believe in the same thing. They obviously weren't ready at that point where they needed our assistance to come in and try and create some ideal form of government for them.
Well, you know, it's you know,
I think one thing.
Hold on, let's just a second. Let Maya go.
If there's really 33 million people over there protesting this, there's nothing that could have stopped this. And if that's happening in Egypt and they're pushing out, you know, they became a republic not too long ago. And they had their first democratically elected, and they have a taste for it now. We should pull completely out of there. If almost half of that country, I mean, their population is like 218 people to square mile. Here in America, it's like, what, 80? So they're a very dense country, so they don't have the same stipulations we would have as far as on protesting. But if there's that many people doing that, and there's all this stuff happening, you know, Libya learned its lesson that maybe globalism isn't a good thing. Maybe we should stand up for ourselves. All these countries, it would be a great thing for them all of them, to go into massive riots like this and throw out their government, because things have fallen. Think of where they were at in the 50s and the progress they were making to civilized societies and everything else.
Yep.
And it downturned, and then we got involved for whatever reason. I'm not saying we caused it, but we got involved, and we didn't really make it better at all. It just hasn't gotten better because of us. So if we pull out, and we're not giving this false sense of security, or we're not accidentally helping the wrong side, I hope the Middle East just goes up into flames, not literal flames, but, you know, 33 million people, almost half a country protesting at once, forcing the government to throw out, or forcing the military to throw out a government. I hope every country in the Middle East does it and has a giant reset. There's, you know, the religious law over there is just suffocating. and hopefully they could turn everything around and build their own prosperity and not have to rely on countries like us to give them money and get bullied around by people. That would be the best thing to see.
Part of their problem, too, is that a majority of their economy is tourism. And who wants to go visit Egypt right now? I certainly don't.
And bad economies.
Mine does.
Bad economies.
And I'll go to Egypt.
It's the largest happening ever. This is 33 million people who would not want to see this. I would love to be able to just be like in a helicopter, a bubble, or a drone and just watch it. This is something. Okay.
Wait a minute. The moment that you join a drone, it's no longer a drone.
I think some, an important angle to look at this, though, is that it really, really makes the narrative that we have had on the Middle East for the better part of, you know, 10, 20 years, it makes it a lot more convoluted than I think Americans are used to. I mean, for the most part, particularly during the Bush administration, the narrative had always been like, you know, the Al-Qaeda specifically was, you know, the enemy, and people who abetted the enemy, you know, you're either with us, you're against us, all this kind of stuff. It was very black and white. Now we have, you know, a situation where, you know, not only did the original, in the 2011 uprising in Egypt, you had the Islamist fundamentalist group come to power by democratic principles. That, you know, they were popularly elected, and that, you know, that kind of screwed with people's heads, because you have the people of this country supported the people that we think they shouldn't, and now you have, you know, we let them come to power, now you have these people falling because I just think the volatility, the fact that there isn't anything as, you know, entrenched as, you know, our perspective, like, we would expect. I mean, you know, it's almost unprecedented to an extent that somebody, that an entirely new government would come to an existence, an entirely new constitution, all based upon populist, you know, just the people just wanted it, and now it's already changed again because the guy that got in sucked. I mean, I can't think of any real country where on such a large scale as Egypt that's happened before. You know, it's been that quick, and I think it turns a lot of the particularly neoconservative, you know, picture that they try to paint about the Middle East. I think it turns it on its head. I think it's something they've never experienced before, And honestly, I don't know if they know what they know how to deal with it. I mean, you know, and this just happens, and this isn't generally in all of the Middle East. I mean, you have people like John McCain going over there and taking pictures with people who are admitted terrorists. I mean, I honestly don't know. They don't know what the heck they're. The neoconservative wing of the Republican Party and just the government in general, they have no idea what the heck is going on, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, just based upon how everything's going, like everything's acting in the Middle East right now, they don't know what the heck's going on, and I don't think a lot of people in America really know what's going on at all. And I think it's interesting because I think it's flipped, you know, it's flipped how we look at the Middle East on its head.
Maya, doesn't this sort of prove your point, though? Because here you have, you've been a little bit vindicated here, I think. Don't you have, you have a country that develops a constitutional republic. They get in, they find the Constitutional Republic distasteful, so they overthrow the government. I mean, in a way, it sort of just speaks to the people are in charge of their own lives, and they can create any form of government they want if they demand it in a certain way.
What do you mean by certain? Could you define what you mean by certain way?
I think when a population is motivated to change the form of government, which if you read the Declaration of Independence, I mean, that's exactly a lot of what is in the Declaration of Independence is directly happening in Egypt today.
Okay.
In changing their form of government.
You know, I mean, okay, remember how they talk about the 3% here, right? The 3% that fought. They're at 50. They're, well, like more like 47%. But, I mean, who cares? We really should just watch this in amazement and awe. I don't, you know, and if our government says word one about this or tries to do anything, I think we ought to dismantle our government. Because we would be actively infringing upon a country building their own thing. And you know what? I kind of hope Egypt does this every 10 to 15 years. Because it would keep...
Like Jefferson said.
Jefferson
crushing the Tree of Liberty. Yes.
Did Tina just take her shirt off?
No, yep.
She has a shawl on because it's 63 degrees in my apartment.
So how do you think the Egypt thing is going to play out? I mean, are the factions going to go to war with themselves?
No.
Or
they,
are things going to calm down and get organized?
They are already moving to set up the I don't know what word they used. One of the leaders of the military came out and said that they already have their constitutional convention going right now. And what the people were saying is like, yeah, that constitution thing that we kind of had going here, it wasn't good enough. We want more. We want everyone to be included in this government, everyone to be included and live freely in this country is what one of the big main things have been, other than the anti-Obama rants have been going viral through this entire crowd. And they love American people. Have you seen all the signs? They love American people, and they feel bad for us. They hate Obama.
You know what? You're right, because I saw a sign today. It was actually on the front of Drudge. It said, "Obama, your bitch is our dictator."
But they already have a process. It's already basically kind of in the works. They didn't go into this to go, "Hey, let's have a coup," and then, oh no, there's some momentum. There's already something kind of in place to get this back up. These people don't want to have their quote unquote, you know, coup and revolution, and then have to sit on it. They've already got a process going. They already know what they want, and it's not going to take long at all for this to play itself out and then to go right back on with more freedom.
Who initiated that process and who's involved in this constitutional convention?
Let's start with Maya. Let's go around and talk about what implications, what lessons can Americans learn about change within their own government. I'm not saying overthrowing the government, changing the constitution, but I'm talking about political action and some of the examples that they've had throughout the Arab Spring up until now, and the way that they've been able to force change as a focused population. What lessons can we as American citizens learn from the Arab Spring, and especially in Egypt, Maya?
I think it is that we don't all, you know, they've lived under tyranny for a very long time and dictatorships and just all kinds of crap, really. And there's only 84 million of them, and they don't have the infrastructure we do. They don't have the systems in place we do. Here in America, we have, 320 million or so people, depending on how you count legal immigrants. So there's like 320-something-odd million people in this country. We wouldn't really need that many. We could get 30 million easy. And there's no reason why we could realistically march on Washington. We could get our military friends, our family, and we could march on Washington and say, hey, we don't agree to this anymore. And we realize that we have no power in the voting booth because the laws become too restrictive, which is exactly what they're doing in Egypt. And they have been, and some of the things that have happened in the Middle East are going on, is they're basically like, we're not going to sit here and let you people stay in power over us. It only took a year for Egypt to go for this. We've been complaining and, you know, absolute bitching for, 150 years now about all kinds of stuff. And we've been having all these problems with, you know, tax and everything else. But we just keep going to the government going, well, Can you please, you know, stop that? Can you please help us out here? No, it took a year for Egypt to have half the country march. I think what we can really learn from this, and I think the implications we can get come from it, is that maybe we just need to all go outside tomorrow on our so-called Dependence Day and just go ahead and just get in our cars, drive to our state capitals, everything else, say, cut it out. We want to have a reset push on this. Let's think about this and just reset this crap, and let's get, you know, can we have some freedom? If not, get the hell out of our buildings.
Greg?
No, I agree with Maya. The only thing I would say is where you said, look at Egypt, they have nothing, you know, no infrastructure, nothing like that. For
no, I said they don't have an infrastructure like we do.
Yes, and so
I mean, ours is, for our internet, everything else, ours just doesn't get just turned off. I'm saying they have an infrastructure. And it's not like a third. It's not third world country.
No.
But their entire country is also not completely, you know, built up. Versus every last inch of our country is.
Yeah, they're not a leading technological country.
I'm not saying they're way behind us, but
no. And my point on that is, the average citizen has a lot more to lose from revolution in the United States than you do in Egypt. They have 1 year old democracy. They don't like it. They're done with it. It's fresh in their minds. We have 100 or 250 years.
We've already lost ours.
I know, but we still get a lot of goodies. The average American still gets a lot of goodies. Their life's relatively safe. It's not.
We still have a democracy. We just may not have a constitutional republic as it was designed.
And so when you have that much to lose and you're that proud of your history and you have all that heritage, I think it takes a lot more to get us up off the couch to go out and revolt. Whereas for the Egyptians, it's a year old. And then actually, I think the solution for Egypt is probably similar, since tomorrow's July 4th, to what that would look like is when we declared independence, it was 13 colonies, 13 independent colonies. There wasn't a formal federal government yet. And I think for them, given they have such a diverse population of how they want their society structured, something like that would probably work best. You know, an area of Coptic Christians, an area of maybe represented by the Muslim Brotherhood, and then an area of maybe completely non-religiously affiliated state.
Let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you think? What lessons can we learn as Americans from the Arab Spring?
I don't know what lessons we can learn. I see the point of, you know, maybe we should get everyone together tomorrow and make the same kind of impact and send the same kind of message. But I question whether or not, you know, like you said, we would be able to keep our constitutional republic in that kind of event, because people are so educated or non-educated to a certain degree now that if on ground zero we still have liberals arguing with libertarians and conservatives arguing different arguments, and it's all kind of the same arguments now without a system in place where, you know, things are being done slowly. It's just kind of a bunch of Indians who are frantically scattering around without a chief. Maya, that statement probably pisses you off, right? But how would you go about it? You know, if we completely dismantled our government tomorrow, how could you guarantee that the Constitution is what surfaces at the end of the debate?
Who says you want the Constitution to surface at the end of the debate? Who says we want to kick back the
But it could be something
years?
A lot worse, right?
It could be a lot worse. It could be a lot better. It could be nothing. Maybe we
can
have
true
freedom.
Are you willing to try your hand at that and potentially get something that's a lot worse?
You know what? We experimented with the Constitution in the first place, correct? We made a great leap in faith that we thought humanity and humankind was ready to live with their own freedom and their own responsibilities, right? Well, why not take that one step further? What would really be the harm? And what would be the harm of allowing people like me and the many, many like-minded people like me to kind of live on our own, where you know you can have your small government, your limited government, just don't force it on us? Maybe this entire massive country doesn't have to be forced into the same little, you know, doesn't have to be pigeonholed. Maybe I can live free, you can live with your little limited government. Hell, out in California, they can have a communism for all we care. But why not? Why would that be such a horrible thing to try? Is, you know, go back and kind of redo the whole 50 states, the separate states?
Because Texas.
Was that a Wendy Davis comment,
that's
Gina?
So don't blame just it on Texas. I don't even know where
that
I was at.
That was just for the win.
I'm a Texan.
See, don't that's the thing Texas. Is if you can gather into societies where you want to live as you see fit, I have a serious issue with not having a backstop in almost a federal bill of rights, something like that, to protect the minority. Like, that was my problem with Egypt. They drafted their constitution in the first article. Everything shall be interpreted from Sharia law. Well, that's great, except for the women.
Anarchism, yeah. There is no majority. It is nothing but individuals.
Sure, but if you want to live together in a society and you're free and you can voluntarily join, and how can you guarantee that the women in that area aren't suppressed?
I know Creighton's dying to get in here. But Creighton, hold on, let Creighton go. Just trying to manage the three ring circus.
Well, I don't want to drag the talk into a discussion over the viability of anarchism or not, because I think that's an entirely different discussion. You asked what are the implications of this revolution. I think I'm still at the point to say that we still have to find out. You know, it's fun to say revolutions are, you know, inherently good because they represent the will of the people and whatnot. But, I mean, historically, revolutions have been, you know, bloody before they've been peaceful. You know, the revolution that Egypt had was, you know, not the norm. Our revolution in the United States was not the norm. Revolutions are usually bloody and terrible, and that's why you get things like, you know, Napoleon, or you get these characters that take over because revolutions are so, you know, terrible. So at this point, the Egypt revolution, it doesn't necessarily look like it's going away. It's been relatively nonviolent. I know that there's been a lot of cases, claims that there's been a lot of sexual assault. I think 8 people have died this time around. I think a lot of people died in the 2011 one, but it wasn't anything that was like on the level of like the French Revolution.
Yeah, Swedish journalist was raped.
I don't,
Dutch,
huh?
Dutch was raped in the square like Lara Logan was 2 years ago. I mean, some of the conditions there, especially for women in Tahrir Square, it's just horrific.
33 million people. What you gonna do?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, but I mean, economic systems go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking out loud. I honestly think it's an interesting thing to watch. As far as, you know, the viability of an American revolution at this point, I think I'm more on the side of Greg. I don't see it as being so. I think comparing the Egypt revolution to ours is very apples and oranges. We have an entirely. The biggest reason that a revolution won't work in America is because we can't even get people out to voluntarily change the people who rule over them. You know, through the easiest means possible, which is to just go vote.
Right.
I mean, we can't even get half of Americans to do that, let alone enough Americans to go out into the street and forcibly change the government the Constitution.
Yeah, I think the difference is the insanely
Americans
high...
They just don't care enough.
We just need politicians that will enforce the laws we already have.
The difference is the insanely high unemployment rate in Egypt. And so when you have those financial pressures pushing down, I mean, since the Arab Spring, the Egyptian tourism industry has just collapsed, and that has put a lot of people out of work. And so you're not going to get the same kind of street protest in America that you're going to get there. You saw it during the Great Depression. People were out protesting during the Great Depression in numbers. They were protesting in great numbers, you know, especially labor unions when they mobilized people. Greg and Maya were talking about something, and then we're going to go to Travis Wyke.
No, I mean, I just feel that, you know, what allows strong men to arise are poor economies, like you said, and economic systems hate chaos. And so I feel like the longer this drags out, the worse the economy gets. 1/8 of their GDP is gas subsidies for fuel. So I see a scenario where the economy gets bad and they're not able to meet their obligations to their citizens, and you see a strongman populist like a Huey Long come up and be very, hey, I'll get you this, and then start blaming others for, like, a lot like Hitler, start blaming others for their problems.
That's a possibility.
Yeah.
Anything is possible.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, we had a revolution. It was very violent, very bloody revolution. And not that many people really were involved. I could literally probably get 100 people together and shut down the entire government of Indiana overnight. It wouldn't be hard. It wouldn't hurt anybody. But you could shut it down long enough to get people go, hey, maybe we need to do something about this. And it's simple.
That's not true. Every single American was involved in the American Revolution. There were people who disagreed.
There's a lot of people that wanted nothing to do with it. They just wanted to live their lives.
The entire country was at war.
And there was a lot of people that wanted to get away from it and not have anything to do with it. As you get with any kind of conflict.
The problem is, though, you know, it's easy to look at the bright spots of revolutions throughout history, but it's also easy to forget that when you talk about prescribing revolutions, you can have the possibility of getting things like a Stalin and a Hitler in power.
But you know
who
what?
Kill millions and millions and millions of people.
But you know what?
I mean, that is a legitimate possibility that, honestly, I don't think it's worth the cost.
Hold on.
You're talking about mass genocide as a possibility. I don't know if that's worth
government
the cost
has
of not trying to do it through an incrementalist perspective.
Okay, your incrementalism has killed hundreds of thousands of people, starving millions of people around the world with everything else. So your incrementalism is killing people here.
No.
It's killing people around the world.
The United States government does not represent incrementalism. Actions of the U.S. government is not a black mark on trying to change that government from doing things like that in the future.
Okay,
that's a red herring. You can't make that comparison.
But so there's a risk that your way could turn into complete tyranny, and there's a risk that my way could turn into complete tyranny. Now, we are almost at tyranny right now. What would be so bad about trying it my way? That would be a little bit more there'd be a little bit more control over it, to say, versus yours, you have no power, you have no control. Maybe if we leveled the playing field a little bit, instead of having a rock and a slingshot versus a tank, it'd be at least like a Jeep with the 50 cal on it versus a tank. You know, my way, there's because a little bit more equality and power. Your way is begging the government, begging and pleading with your masters for a little more freedom.
That's not
that they
at
stole.
All what incrementalism is.
Is it
That's
not?
Not at all what incrementalism is.
We know, we got to compromise, you know. You know, we can't have everything at once, so we'll slowly get rid of the IRS while they build up another IRS, and we'll slowly get rid of that while they take away this. You know, we legalize pot in Colorado, then they restrict all kind of economic freedom. We legalize gay marriage, then we start, you know, taking
all right.
away something
Hold
else.
Hold on,
so,
let don't,
incrementalism.
Don't my
yeah,
bust,
it's
don't
hard.
My buster here, let Creighton respond.
Yeah, so it's hard. What you, the thing is we can't even, like I said, we can't get, if you're talking about an absolute revolution, a total revolution, that requires every single person in the country to be involved. We're talking about it. I'm talking about a situation where you set, you know, the political infrastructure is already in place. Getting to a point where you have enough people who believe in something to make change in that system is so much easier and requires less resources than getting a fire under everybody's ass to the point where they actually want to take over the country. You're talking about something that is, you know, not just like, I mean, it sounds nice, but it is literally almost in the current setup of America, the way the world is right now, it is just not viable. Saying that, you know, it's, you know, if we can slowly try and get rid of the IRS, and we can, you know, we legalize pot, and then they try and take over more economic control. Yeah, it's hard. It takes effort. It takes dedication. And it takes a lifetime of work. But to say that it's not worth it because, you know, you can't, there's no such thing as being a kind of a slave, so it's the moral obligation is to take over, is to get rid of everything at once. I mean, honestly, we are not in that kind of situation where that is viable. And incrementalism is just essentially just a fancy way of saying get enough people together in the United States who believe in, say, libertarian principles to change the federal government to reflect those principles. There will be other factions that disagree with what you're trying to do, and they will work against you, but that doesn't mean, oh, okay, well, I guess this option doesn't work because it's going to be too hard because people disagree with us. And I mean, it's unfathomable to me, that people can think that because it's hard, that it's going to be, that there's a better way, right, that it's more preferable
no.
to just completely throw the entire
no.
system on
you're,
its head and
words
throw millions
in my mouth
of people
and other people's
into
mouths.
Simply chaos.
No. Okay, you just called anarchy chaos. If you ever
what?
Call yourself an anarcho-capitalist again, you should just eat your foot. Now, I'm not saying I disagree with incrementalism because it's too hard. Never have I said it's too hard. It doesn't work. 1913, we instituted the income tax. It's been 100 years. It's gotten no better. It's gotten, what, almost 80,000 pages? Nothing has worked. We had Barry Goldwater with a massive amount of support 50, you know, 60 years ago. We had massive amounts of more libertarian thought 100 years ago, and nothing has improved.
I didn't hear
improved.
Any of that last part.
Everything, nothing's improved. So, you know, that's fine. But it's not that incrementalism's too hard. It doesn't work. Voting percentages
Wait, is my turn to talk?
Have consistently dropped. Constantly dropped since
I see Maya's
forever.
Lips moving, but I can't hear what she's saying.
It doesn't
yeah,
matter
Maya's
what
muted.
I'm saying. So,
oh, okay.
You know, it's. I'm not saying incrementalism's hard. I'm saying that it's failed. It's a flawed logic because it obviously hasn't worked. Nothing we've fought for has improved. Nothing all has gotten better unless people care.
All right, let's get one last comment on Egypt from Travis Wyke. Travis, you are active duty. What is your title with the federal government? And you are speaking on behalf of yourself and not on anyone else's behalf. So let's make that clear. You are here as a private citizen.
Right. I'm a staff sergeant in the Indiana National Guard. And so right now I'm just on like regular citizen soldier status. I'm not activated or anything like that. The thing in Egypt, it concerns me, but I haven't heard anything about it. It seems like the Egyptian military is doing what they're supposed to and standing up for the country and, you know, doing what the people want them to do. When it comes to us having to go over there, I don't think we should. I think, you know, their country's doing it right. They're taking care of themselves. And I don't know, you know, besides, you know, oil and resources and stuff like that, there's no reason for us to get involved. It doesn't affect our security at all. That's my opinion.
What kind of lessons do you think we can learn from their revolution here in changing the government?
I think, you know, we do have the National Guard set up. We also have the different state militias. In Indiana, we have the Indiana Guard Reserve, which is an all-volunteer force that only answers to the governor. I think if something happened where there was a military coup, where all of a sudden active duty army or whatever decided that they were going to oust President Obama and put him on house arrest on, you know, 1600 Pennsylvania, I think that, you know, I'd get a call that says go protect the Indiana-Ohio border or something like that. And our system's set up like that, you know, protect Indiana in the interest of Indiana before I do the federal government. And there are a lot of people that do that. Again, it still comes down to my state's better than your state because I live here. But, you know, we do have a system set in place to protect the infrastructures.
I'm going to ask you before we're going to move on to a different topic, because this is a topic that we've argued a little bit about in the chat room. And the mood in here is already tense. So this has the ability to just tear everything apart. And this might be the end of the show, this topic right here.
Okay. Much to the relief of everyone.
Much to the relief of everyone listening to this podcast, this might be the last topic we ever do. One of the questions that I've heard posed after the DOMA ruling was, should military chaplains be forced to marry same-sex couples?
We're going there.
Yep. Should same-sex couples, if they want to get married, if they're in the military, should a military chaplain be forced to marry them if they have a religious objection? So we're going to start with Travis, because Travis probably has the most familiarity with this topic.
When it comes to chaplains, they shouldn't put one religion above the other. That's the whole thing. I've actually heard Maya talk about this before, that chaplains are there more for a counselor perspective. They're there to go ahead and, you know, maybe do a blessing over the infantry guys before they go do whatever they got to do. But they're not there to proselytize and put one religion above another. They have a religious affiliation themselves, and they have to be affiliated with a church or a religious body of some sort, but they don't really get a pick and choose. So if somebody walks in, you know, two guys walk in, two girls walk in and say, we want you to marry us, then not marrying them because of religious beliefs would be discrimination.
But what if it violates their fundamental personal principles, and that is enshrined in our Constitution in the First Amendment, religious freedom?
It's not in the UCMJ.
Mm-hmm. But so you can sign a contract.
When you sign a contract, you sign a contract, you're no longer a citizen.
Let me finish and make my point. You can sign a contract that can take away the very rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, your natural rights. I can make you sign a piece of paper right now.
Yes.
Okay.
Hold on, Maya. Hold on. When it comes to, and I know Maya has a different perspective of this because she was active duty Air Force. Mm-hmm. So she was absolutely 365 in the military mindset. And I'm, you know, 10% of my time spent military. But when it comes to religious practices, in the military, it's mission first, and they preach that. If you want to fast for Ramadan, if you're a practicing Muslim soldier, your responsibilities come to the military first. So it's mission first. So you can't practice your fasting for Ramadan if it will make you weaker and not allow you to accomplish whatever the mission is. So your commander can tell you, okay, you can skip breakfast, but you're going to, you know, eat whatever's at chow because you have to go out on a road march or right. Something like that. So in the same vein, if your Southern Baptist chaplain in the military and, you know, a couple comes in and says, we want you to marry us, you could be screwing with unit morale and mission accomplishment if you don't allow them to do that. If you make a huge stink and discriminate against that, that could go ahead and...
But couldn't you make the opposite argument? If you, I'm not saying that same-sex couples should be discriminated against at all. I'm saying that they at all times should have the ability to be married by a chaplain. But I'm saying that why are we not being equal across the board? If a person has a fundamental problem that violates their personal values as an individual, why do are they forced to marry? Go ahead, Maya.
Okay.
Do you understand what I'm saying? As long as someone else is there to fulfill the duty,
there's not always, especially if you're downrange or you're at a small base, you don't have 300 chaplains. You'll have one or two. I only met two chaplains at my base in 2.5 years. So, and you don't know what the denomination is, and they don't easily tell you what their denomination is necessarily or what subsect of their denomination they tell you they are. It's when you're in the military, you're no longer a citizen, a human being. You're a soldier. And like he said, well, I know it's different for the National Guard and everything else, but, you know, active duty military, that's a whole different world. When you sign that piece of paper, you don't have a life. They control how you walk, how you look, how you eat. They can control every last single decision you make. There was, until they just now repealed it, there was saying something in the UCMJ basically saying you can only have sex in the missionary position.
Really?
I'm not kidding. Now, I think it was Article 135.
Now, Travis, we don't want to get
mission
you in
first.
It. Travis, we don't want to get you any trouble, but have you ever violated military code?
Yes.
Say no. Say no.
No, that was a joke. No. He's joking.
That's no. Why Bill I may Clinton or may not served. Have ever violated
no,
military
code. No, you can't even say that.
Orders.
That's still admitting. The military doesn't work the same way.
90% of the time, I'm civilian, Maya. I can do what I want except on drill weekends.
No, but with the chaplain thing, it's a different world in the military. It really is. I don't agree with it. I'm just telling you how it is. If you join the military, you know that you're going to have to counsel Muslims. That you might have to get advice to Muslims. Some Christians might not like that. Maybe a Jewish guy, he's probably not going to really necessarily want to do that. But you're not there to. As a Southern Baptist, if you join the military to be a chaplain, you're not bringing your Southern Baptistism with you. You're bringing counseling. You're bringing morale.
You've
agreed to do everything the military tells you.
Yeah, this is to me. This seems crazy. It's voluntary. In the legal system, if you can't afford an attorney, we provide a public defender. In the military, if your chaplain who's in your
if you can't area, get to your
we will
place
provide
of
a chaplain who
we'll
will
provide,
do it. I mean, it's like this is
yeah,
over.
Spangle,
what's
next? I think your argument is predicated upon there being a draft.
Sure. Here's my fundamental thing that I just can't wrap my head around. How do you, Travis and Maya? It's not just about this issue. I understand exactly what you're saying, and it makes sense. As two strong individualists, as people who believe in individualism, as libertarians, how do you make that choice to give up free will to be an independent person? I just can't imagine signing any kind of contract that relinquishes...
Being 17 years old and an idiot not knowing what you're doing with your life?
Fair enough.
That's how they got me. I wasn't really in politics... I was 17 when I joined the military. Right.
But didn't you sign an employment contract at Englehart?
Yeah, but I can...
No, that's
so you don't have total control of your time anymore?
No,
or
that,
your actions
he's
reflect...
He's selling his time. In
right.
the military,
you're
you
paid.
Sell much more in your time.
But you're getting paid.
You give up things you're not technically, even under the most basic of libertarian philosophers, you can't... I don't know who does say you can, but you can't sell yourself. And that is what you do in the military. You can't sell yourself into slavery. That doesn't work. And I get what you're saying, Chris, but, you know, the whole nationalism patriotism. Mm-hmm. You think you're doing, you're sacrificing for a good cause. You think you're doing something above and beyond the call of, you know, the call of duty. You're doing more than say, you know, that firefighter, he goes home at night and, you know, they stay local. And that's, you know, kind of the National Guard. It's a different story there too. But when you go active duty, you sell your soul to the U.S. government. And when you start getting the clearances and everything else, no, your soul is gone.
Right.
You know, we worked a Panama schedule. I never really had days off. For 2.5 years, I almost never had days off. And, you know, I ended up volunteering for multiple deployments because I was an idiot and I wanted to go overseas and shoot stuff. But, you know, your life's gone. You don't have a life. And the reason for doing it is vast. There's a vast amount of reasons why people do it. But it doesn't seem, unless you're coming from a libertarian's perspective already, you'd never do it. But it doesn't seem like you're selling yourself, because the average person doesn't realize what freedom is, or that they have uninfringable rights.
Or this is the problem with government. It forces people to defend their values, and this is government is forced. We talk about this all the time, but this is a very clear example. And I think this is a discussion that we're going to have a lot as we change culturally, as we make sure that everyone is treated equally under the law. I think you're going to see people who have had it their way for a long time start to buck the system a little bit and say, well, now we're the minority class. And you're already seeing that from people on the religious right. But there does need to be I think it's a question that we do have to think about, because, for instance, the 501c3 exemption. I think everybody in this room would say, why do we have a 501c3 exemption for churches, for instance? Why are they granted tax-exempt status?
Right.
Okay? So if you take that tax-exempt status as a church, should the government force you to marry same-sex couples if your church fundamentally disagrees with that?
Well, we have to keep in mind, Spangle, that this is not the first time that this type of cultural shift has happened.
Sure.
Would you feel the same way or pose the same questions if the situation was, should a chaplain be forced to marry an interracial couple?
No, it's totally different because...
How?
Because the Bible is very clear when it comes to homosexual relationships in the New Testament. It's
are you
not
aware
the same
of
way.
The, are
Look
you
at
aware
Samson
of the
and
arguments?
Delilah. Samson and Delilah were an interracial couple.
Which
your
is
argument,
they...
Your argument in using that line of thinking is invalid.
Okay, Spangle, but what you are not aware of is during the 50s and 60s, there was a huge, tremendous propaganda wave that stated that that Cain and Abel, the mark of the beast, was dark skin. They have... historically always use the Bible,
but you're trying to paint me as some, but hold on, you're getting mad, you're trying
to paint you as anything. I asked you a question.
You're getting a little
bit. The question that I asked you was, would you pose the same questions if it were an interracial couple?
No, I wouldn't, because it's a totally different it's a totally different question. You're comparing apples to oranges.
I absolutely am not. The last time this exact same wave happened, it was racially related, and I am telling you right now, I attended churches in my lifetime since 1990 where they still teach that being black is the mark of the devil, that was what the punishment that God cast down from Cain and Abel. The Bible has absolutely been used as a weapon. The Bible has absolutely been used as a tool to create separation and tension and cultural rift. So right now, what people focus on from a propaganda standpoint is the gay thing in the Bible. But I'm telling you, not 25, 30 years ago, what people focused on was the race issue.
But you were
in
talking about your personal interpretation of something, and I'm talking about somebody else's personal interpretation.
I'm not talking
of something
about my
personal
interpretation
values.
Of anything at all. I am comparing the last time a minority segment of our population was oppressed using something like a religious tool such as a Bible.
So let me ask you.
Okay.
If a church gets a 501c3 tax, hold on. If a church gets a 501c3 tax exempt status, should they be forced to marry same-sex couples if they disagree with that?
If they're receiving 501c3, I personally believe that if you're receiving funding from the government, which is different from exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
If you're receiving funding from the government, then yes, you have to play by our rules.
But
if you're receiving exemptions, you know, that's a slippery slope. And as someone who doesn't necessarily agree with the tax code as it's written anyway, I have fundamental issues that
a statist would view it as the government is giving you money by creating a tax exemption.
But that's a loaded question, because the tax system as now isn't free and equal, and so that's kind of a loaded question versus if you had, you know, people say if you passed a fair tax, it wouldn't matter. Everyone had to pay tax anyways. But and then you're both the standpoints. Remember, there's 38,000 sects of Christianity. Mm-hmm. There's many, many different kinds of Bibles and different interpretations of Bibles. So none of your opinions matter at all when it comes to law.
It's not about my opinions. I'm saying have different values.
Right. And churches should not be forced to do anything.
Right.
Ever. Anything. I don't think churches pay taxes. Because paying taxes, you assume that you also get something from it. By not paying taxes and being 501c3, they can't be involved politically. That's a fair trade-off.
Anyone else think?
I don't know. Give him an out clause. I abstain. We'll fly one in. He'll do the ceremony. What's next? And like for the Bible, I mean, yes, you have religious freedom. You absolutely do. So that's why I think that you need to be able to abstain. But as far as a church goes, I'm like Gina. They're exempt. They're not a for-profit institution regardless. The fundraising they do use money for usually goes to help people towards charity or to build infrastructure to increase their flock. So I don't see it as something where you would get rid of that and then start taxing them necessarily. It would bring down – really, it would increase the need for a more redistributive welfare state if you got rid of that status for the church. So it's pragmatic for the state to say – you're a chaplain. Here's the exemption for the church. You can abstain. We'll fly one in. No problem.
Creighton, Joe?
I'm just interested that I'm not alone. I thought going into this conversation today that there was going to be like five people attacking the position that I took on it during the week and that I was just going to have to defend myself. It seems like it's a little more even.
What was your position?
You want me to tell my position?
Yeah, give us a little synopsis. Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking just in terms of dollars and cents, that because a chaplain is a soldier first, and a chaplain is his position that he's given later on. He is a publicly paid employee, and as he is a publicly paid employee, via the tax dollars of every working American, there are gay people who work and pay taxes, and as such, he should be forced to, one, either represent fairly those who pay him, or not resume that job title. Just in terms of dollars and cents, I think that it makes it fair.
But we give government employees days off for religious holidays. So you have to give them that way.
And what about Quakers?
Yep. You have to give them an out clause.
What did they? I don't know this. I don't know, Travis. Have you heard any speak about this? With the repeal DOMA and moving things in, are they giving chaplains an out? Are they giving, saying, hey, chaplains, if you don't agree with this and this, Would you guys think that'd be absolutely fair if they gave them a clear and free honorable discharge from the military if they disagreed with ever having to do a gay marriage?
No, because that would be federal law, not state. Now it goes to the states, and that's a chaplain is a federal employee.
Travis, do you have an answer?
Well, it comes back to the I go to the desegregation of the military at that point. If you didn't like the fact that, if you were white and you didn't like the fact that they were moving black soldiers into your unit, you couldn't leave. You couldn't leave on that basis. So I don't know that they've said you can leave if you don't like that there are gay people in there. If you're a chaplain, you don't like that you have gay soldiers you have to deal with or you have to marry or whatnot and not tell them they're going to burn in hell because then it comes down to a morale thing again.
Right.
But
can you just transfer to another job, though? Do you just, no, I mean, you're a soldier either way.
No.
Why not?
Hold on,
it doesn't
hold on.
Work
active
like
duty.
That.
In active duty, it's really hard to transfer. In the National Guard, it's a little bit easier, but it still comes down to your unit releasing you.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I wanted to go active duty from the National Guard, the Adjutant General of Indiana would have to release me to go active, even to go to another state. So it still comes down to, like Maya said, when you sign up, you are a piece of equipment, and
wow,
your unit owns you, and then the different echelons above you are accountable for you. So you can't just say, "Well, I would rather go to a straight you know, hetero unit, you can't do that. Once you're in the military, it's completely at the needs of the Army.
And remember that the Navy is full of nothing but queers.
Stop. That's spoken like a true Air Force man. And I don't want it to be – this is a question, and the reason I raised the topic, this is a question that has been raised by the – this is where the far Christian right thinks that their next battleground is going to be, that they're going to be infringed upon. And I think it's an interesting question. I understand the military, and you guys have completely convinced me, especially Travis, because Travis obviously serves in the military currently. Joe just serves in the military when he participates in his local YMCA cover band. That's not true.
He's a full-blown operative of the New World Order.
That's right.
Illuminati.
And Creighton's in the Republican Army.
That's right. He's in the Rand Brigade.
The Rand Raiders.
Represent.
Creighton, any final thoughts on this topic?
All I was going to say earlier is that, Spangle, I think your beef is not so much specifically with this
I don't have a beef. I am trying to...
You don't have any beef?
I'm
hungry.
Well, I think the beef you are trying to represent is, by and large, just I think it's better suited to say that they just disagree with the, I guess, quasi-despotism of the military in general. The fact that somebody is forced to do anything that is opposed to their moral beliefs, whatever they may be, seems to be the problem. You know, we're talking about one specific thing that is, you know, religious in nature, but I mean, honestly, the argument can be played out for any moral question, right. And the fact that the military has the authority to do that seems like that's the problem that these people have as far as this debate goes. I think we're just focusing on one specific thing because, you know, gay rights are in the news right now.
And how did we get to the spot as a culture where we accepted that our military would just own our boys and girls that we sent over to battle?
And I've never really thought about it until you guys raised it tonight. I don't know.
It's one of those things. I mean, this is forever ago. I mean, think of the Civil War. They convinced people in the Revolutionary War. They convinced people to stand in lines. Wait for this guy over here to tell you to fire after they got the fire first. Tell me that made sense.
Right.
They convinced people to do that way back when people were supposed to be maybe a little bit more free in the head or something. It's always been a thing that you are when you voluntarily sign up to go somewhere like that in an army, because war is unnatural. Because war is unnatural.
You talk about unnatural. Maya's belches are ungodly. I've never smelled a belch before.
She's going to get a warning from the UN because that is like sarin gas.
Something died in that gut today.
I am 29 years old, and in my 29 years, I've never smelled a belch. I mean, Gina, seriously, how bad is it?
For sure, it was like two landfills and Roseanne Barr's feet.
Oh, Roseanne Barr's
feet.
I don't even know what happened to be all the way up in South Bend.
I'll send you a jar.
Even if I was watching this video in mute right now, like I can see that there's these moments throughout the podcast when the spirit just kind of dies a little. Gina and Chris, and like I could point out which points you've just burped.
Because I mean, it's not that it smells any better in here, but
Craig's across the room and his eyes are watering.
I swear to God, earlier during the show, sorry, Spangle, I shouldn't swear to God. earlier,
God will smite you according to Spangle's interpretation of the Bible.
You know, I was so excited.
You try to raise one question.
You know, I was so excited. Last podcast, it was all about how we were moving to Vermont. We were finally going to be happy together. Right. And now it's, I hate you. Why won't you read Romans 1? And then you evangelize like Billy Graham for an entire podcast.
But hold on. With the military thing, remember.
And no, I'm not putting anything in the communion tray.
Listen, me finish my point.
You're
with
not getting out of here without your tithe. It's a love gift, Greg.
With the military thing, I'm going to finish my point, and I'll never say another word on this podcast ever again after this. Whoa, I promise. Nice. Now, did you say nice?
Yeah, right.
No, I will never. After this, I will never come back on this podcast. I decided this about 25 minutes ago. Is with the military, is because war is so unnatural, especially with the way we fight it, is when you get people in a position like that, they can't be normal humans. You can't expect normal humans and normal human thinking to function in military. It mm-hmm. makes no sense. You're shooting at people you don't know. You're not 100% sure of the reasons why you're shooting at said person. Right. You're listening to some guy in a safe old command post shooting at people. You're doing things way above and beyond what a normal person would ever put themselves through for reasons vast. So you can't treat people in the military normal. You have to treat them like machines, like tools, like robots. Yeah. You have to, because think about what they're doing. It's unnatural to be in war. You're getting paid with taxpayer money to soldiers kill people.
Kill things.
Your job is to kill people. But now, especially active duty, and even for like Travis and this, in basic training, on the wall it says we're here to kill people and blow shit up.
Yes.
They weren't allowed to cuss at us, but in basic training, it says we're here to kill people and blow shit up. My job. There were red lines painted all over the place out in that desert. If someone crossed that line and we didn't know who they were and they weren't supposed to be there, we just shot them. We started shooting 203s or something at them and just blew them up, killed them. Don't know, have a clue who they are, but they passed that red line without permission. They didn't have any call sign or anything. There was things where we were told every night we went to work, if something happened, everyone at work that night was going to die. That fundamentally changes how your brain works. Even for people to go overseas and in combat stuff, a human mind's not made to handle that. And it rewires it, so you can't treat those people the same. That's why there's a rule when people are deployed in hot action times, within 5 minutes of waking up, you are not responsible for your actions. I mean, that giant scar I have on my arm right here is from someone shaking me awake not too long after I got a tech school and basic training. I freaked out and stuck my arm through a window. I mean, there's stories of people getting shot overseas because they'll wake somebody up in a panic and the person will grab their gun and shoot somebody. War's not natural. It's against everything that someone that wants freedom and liberty would be against. It's against what normal human beings should want. The only people that really enjoy war and want war are psychopaths, because normal human minds don't do that.
Psychopaths and people who make money off the industry of war.
Also psychopaths.
Yeah. All right, well, let's end on that note. Final thoughts for this episode.
She is out.
Maya dropped the mic and walked off. You can hear her on The Uncontrollables every week on Indiana Talks. Go to theuncontrollables.com. Maya.
She can't even hear you.
Maya
yeah.
and I have been fighting off air. You can't hear it all night. Gina, final thoughts for this episode.
Happy 4th of July. Praise the United States for all of its glory. check out my new show, Storytime with Gina, and The Uncontrollables with Maya, and support Rupert's Kids. That's all I got.
All right, Greg.
Oh, and care about the things going
Let's
on.
Go to Creighton. Creighton, what are your final words?
Fun fact, America was actually born yesterday, July 2nd, 1776, not July 4th. The Declaration of Independence was signed tomorrow, actually tomorrow and in mid-August, but the actual bill that was introduced into the Continental Congress by Richard Henry Lee of Virginia was passed on July 2nd, 1776. So To be specific, America was born yesterday, so we missed the 4th of July for real. But other than that, happy 4th of July, everybody. I'm going to go blow stuff up. I'm probably going to read some Jefferson or something and put on my American flag, Zeebo exercise pants, and roundhouse kick some anti-Americans in the face.
Nice.
Joe?
That's it.
Yeah, well, it was interesting this episode because there were so many people, but
it'll be a good idea. They said
one word, one
right,
word.
Right, right.
It's an anniversary show.
But
they
hey,
said.
But hey, it is.
It'll
50,
be fun.
So hey, congratulations to We Are Libertarians for the 50th episode. I think that's wonderful. It's a cool thing. Yeah, and also congratulations on all of you being extremely sexy.
Thank you.
Mostly Spangleberry.
Travis?
We are the wild and crazy guys.
No, this was a great episode, and I'm glad I got to be on here on you guys' Gold Jubilee.
Great having you, Travis.
Yeah, thank you. Paul Gable is going to send you all sorts of hate mail.
He wanted to call in, and I don't know how he can call in to the Google Hangout, so I said, sorry, buddy. So I have asked him on multiple episodes to come on, and he never can. So, I've
well,
done
he's
my
the press.
Yes.
He's the press, and I am inclined to believe him
right
first.
See, we can't really email him because the NSA has access to his email so, and Facebook and all those things. So, you know, it's a big risk for us.
Is the NSA tied into your tin cans and string?
Well, I have this really nice fluoride-covered tinfoil baseball cap.
Greg, final thoughts?
No, you know what? Read the Declaration of Independence tomorrow. Don't read the Constitution. Don't read anything like that. But read the Declaration of Independence tomorrow in its entirety. Maybe not all the grievances or the grievances that they had, but some more like paragraph one, paragraph two, and the last paragraph. It's really brilliant writing. It embodies what it means when your government doesn't represent you anymore, and how you can act logically, how you can say it earnestly, and so that people will respect you and not call you a kook, and then show that you have the responsibility to protect yourself with a new form of government, and you have the right to do it.
All right, and if you want to hear the declaration, I read it earlier today, and I uploaded it into the podcast feed, and you should already have it in your favorite podcatcher. we've added a bunch of shows, including The Shill Report, The Rob Kendall Show, Storytime with Gina Martinez.
True.
Several various podcasts, so go to wal-radio.com. And, hey, I don't think we can do much better than this episode. What do you guys think?
Oh, man.
It's thrilling.
Nowhere to go from here but up, man.
If you're still listening, you probably have given up all hope.
I think we can do better next week.
No. Man, let's hope so.
I don't know. I don't think we can. All right, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week, and we promise
to do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.